We want to try and continue through the Kuzari. At some point, I guess we'll get as far as we can in the Kuzari until it becomes too difficult, and then we'll switch topics to something else. But I think we have still plenty of material that we still want to cover, and there's a lot coming up now. There will be a part in section two, which is the second essay that we're up to now, which we will skip entirely. It's a very technical discussion of the international dateline according to halakha. We will discuss it outside. We won't discuss it inside. But we have a ways to go before we get there. I want us to get our bearings, and in the course of getting our bearings, to sort of review how we got to this point that we're up to. And it really all goes back to relate to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's unique worldview of the metaphysics of this world. Meaning that for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, this physical world, in a very real way, interacts with the metaphysical realm. That there is something supernatural that is interwoven within the fabric of our physical world. And as a result, there is specialness that is assigned to people, places, and things that have within their metaphysical fabric additional enhancements that are not visible to the human eye. So you and I could be looking at two different people, but because they have something called a neshama or something else that is unique about them, their metaphysical fabric, their metaphysical makeup is very different from the person that's standing right next to them. And it's not just people, it's places, which we're going to learn with. This is really our introduction to the land of Eretz Yisrael, and things as well, such as altars and other specific things that have very specific dimensions that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had discussed, as we remember in the first essay, had talked about the specificity of the mitzvot, why God gives us such very, very specific instructions about how to do things. And the reason is because with physical objects, just like with medicines, you have to be very careful about the dosage and about the chemical combinations. If you're not careful, you end up killing the patient or ending up not giving them any medicine at all. So therefore, it's got to be a lulav and an esrog, not a lulav and a lemon, yeah? And the mizbeach has to be a certain structure and dimension, and if it's off by a couple of inches, then it doesn't have the metaphysical value, nor would one be allowed to even place a korban, a sacrifice upon it. So for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, even though he can't see it, but he can certainly envisage it, he can envision the metaphysical reality that is very, very real and very much intertwined with our physical universe. And that's his worldview. Very, very different from a Maimonidean worldview, where there's greater level of separation between the divine and the physical. So we're not going to focus on the Rambam right now. We've talked about Rambam before, but whenever we talk about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, we cannot avoid to remind ourselves that there is such a dichotomy that exists within Jewish thought between the mystical of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the rational of the Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. Related to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's very, very real definition of the magic that exists within the physical world, he also has a duty to distance physicality from Hashem himself. While acknowledging that the physical realm contains much divinity, what he calls the Amr Allahi in Arabic, or the Inyan HaElokhi, that this divine substance that is present within everything in the physical world, but God himself is completely removed from the physical. And that is more important for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi to emphasize, perhaps even than a Maimonides, because of his overemphasis on the divinity that exists within the physical. So to make sure that you understand that there may be divinity that exists within the physical, but Hashem himself, his truest essence, is not in any way associated with the physical world, it becomes necessary to underscore that idea. And that's really what brings us up to over here, where we were talking about different ways that Hashem is described in Tanakh. And in the course of trying to explain the different attributes of Hashem and the way that we don't have one uniform way of addressing God. God is not consistently Allah in the Tanakh. Sometimes he's Elohim, sometimes he's the four-letter name, sometimes he's Kael, sometimes he's Tzvakot. All different words that are descriptive of a different attribute of God that is manifest in this world, but yet we must still underscore that it is not God himself, but rather a manifestation, an emanation of Hashem that he wishes to demonstrate or to show to mankind. So after he's explained all of these things to us, we are now ready to embark upon our discussion of the specialness of the land of Israel. And that's really where we're going to be starting from today, because we have to talk about people, places, and things. So we're going to focus on places. You know that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has this love of Zion, has this tremendous affection for the land of Israel. And it's not just because it's of a national destiny that he aspires toward, but rather because he sees that this metaphysical fabric that we're talking about, that intertwines itself with the physical world, as far as geographic locations, there is a greater presence of divinity within the land of Israel than any other place in the entire world. And therefore, the objective of every Jew should be able to go to a place where he can accomplish the most spiritually by being closest with that divine fabric. So I'm just going to bring us up to where we are. It's on page 153. If you're joining us for the first time, then just follow along with a friend. But we came into the middle of a discussion about divine manifestations in this world and how God cannot be in any way physical. So the Kuzari says, I now understand, after this long discussion that we started the second essay with, the intricate concept of God's attributes. I also now understand the concepts of the glory of God, emissaries of God, namely angels, and the divine presence. All of these things are visages, are images, or representations of Hashem that God emanates to the physical realm. These terms are used for those things which appear before prophets and other heralds of God. For example, a pillar of cloud, a consuming fire, cloud, thick cloud, fire, and brightness. Now, for Maimonides, for Rambam, many times when a prophet is having an image or a vision of Hashem, there really is no connection whatsoever with the physical world, because as a general rule, a prophet envisions things in his mind. There therefore is no physical representation of God that has to be explained away, because for the Rambam, there is completely no association whatsoever between the divine realm and the physical realm. So if a Navi has a vision, the vision is in his mind. And therefore, the Rambam, in many instances, tells us he has a tendency to distance miraculous and divine phenomena in the physical world unless the Torah tells us explicitly in a very unambiguous way that Hashem brought a miracle. So, for example, for the Rambam, the miracle of the parting of the Red Sea was a physical phenomenon. There's no way to get around that because it says all the Jewish people experienced it. But Yaakov's wrestling match with the angel, according to the Rambam, was a dream. It was not a physical wrestling match. Yechezkel's vision of the dry bones in the valley was a dream, according to the Rambam. It was not a physical phenomenon that he actually went to a valley and saw dry bones that were resurrected. Because for the Rambam, for God to insert himself into the physical realm is really somewhat of an anomaly. It's very, very rare and only happens upon extraordinary circumstances in very rare occasions within world history. But for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, that there's an intertwining of divinity within this physical world, I have a greater responsibility to explain to you how it's God, but it's really not God, because God cannot be associated with the physical, even though he is in the physical nonetheless. So therefore, these are manifestations of Hashem, but they're not really God's true essence. Very esoteric concept, but you understand that from where the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is coming from, he has this greater need to explain them, because when a prophet has a vision for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, sometimes that vision is in the objective reality of the physical world. It's not just in the mind of the prophet. I hope I'm, am I making myself clear? Okay. So as an analogy, he continues, when it is light outside in the early morning before sunrise, or in the early evening after sunset, or on a cloudy day, we say that the light is shining directly from the sun, even though the sun is hidden. But this is not correct. In other words, we don't say it's really the sun is not out right now. The sun is already set, and yet we still see the pink and the yellow of the sun's light in the horizon. Rather, the sun's light is refracted off the objects which are situated in front of the sun, and it is those objects which reflect that light to us. And this is the metaphor that he is using to explain how God represents himself in this physical world. There are miraculous divine phenomena that are present in our world, but they're not God. The burning bush was real. The wrestling match with the angel was real. The resurrection of the dry bones was real. But it's not God himself who is actually manipulating the physical world. These are refractions of God. They are God's way of giving some kind of emanation of his light without him actually inserting himself in the physical world. Now, why is this an important discussion? It may not be that important for you and me, because for you and me, the technical mechanics of divinity are not really, you know, we're not getting doctorates in divinity, right? In other words, so that's like, for us, that's not such a pressing matter. But for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, it's a very pressing matter, because he is polemicizing and trying to establish the theological underpinnings of Judaism in a world amidst Islam and Christianity. And these two competing religions have extremes on either side that go against Judaism. On the one hand, Christianity is very much in favor of placing God in the physical world, right? Because of the Son of God, right? And Islam, to the other extreme, is saying that there is in no way, shape, or form that Allah can be associated with the physical world at all, to the point where Muhammad did not study the Quran from God. Muhammad studied the Quran from the angel Gabriel, because there can be no interaction between Allah and this world based upon, you know, Greek philosophical models about the transcendence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So we are trying to put, at least it sounds like he's trying to position Judaism somewhere in between these two competing theological schools. And also, of course, Islam is sort of one in this discussion with philosophy, with the Greek philosophy of his time, which describes the metaphysics of God. Okay, so that's really all by way of introduction. So the rabbi says in paragraph 8, that's correct. And in like manner, the glory of God is a reflection of divine light, kavod Hashem, whenever we find that in the Torah, it's a reflection of divine light which provides benefit to his people and his land. So there's a certain glory of God that rests upon the Jewish nation, which gives us our special qualities. We call it, you know, a Yiddish neshama. There's a pintle yid, or whatever you want to call it, but there's something special about the essence of the Jew. And we've talked about that essential difference between Jews and non-Jews. And he says that has to do with the glory of God that is imbued within the Jewish nation. Plus, there's a glory of God, a special kind of divinity that is imbued into the land of Israel as well. So this immediately evokes a curiosity on behalf of the Khazar king, because after all, if you're the king of the Khazars, then you think that the Khazar land is the most special country of all, right? Because every king should view his country as being the best place in the world. So the Khuzari says, your statement regarding his people is clear to me, but your statement about his land is difficult to accept. How can it be that there's one place in the world which is more special than another place in the world? The world, when you think about it, is a sphere. So a sphere, every point on the sphere is equidistant from the midpoint. There's nothing more special or less special than any particular place in the world. So why should the land of Israel be more special than any other place in the world? So the rabbi's answer is, and this is where we're going to begin our discussion of Eretz Yisrael, says, any, by the way, any questions at this point? Any comments, questions at this point? Yes, Mrs. Sokachevsky.
I'm still thinking about what you said before, that that everything that we do the mitzvahs with to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has to be exactly the way it is. You can't take a lulav and lemon, you have to take a lulav and Ezra. How would Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi understand that discussion? I don't remember where it is. Why does it matter to Hashem if you slaughter an animal on his neck or someone else or someplace else, but yeah, it comes with tzarek? The mitzvahs, it doesn't matter to Hashem, but it, the mitzvahs come with tzarek as a real, I think.
Yeah, we had that discussion. You know, we talked, this was the very...
absent.
No, you were there, because you're actually quoting the Rambam. You're quoting from the Mora Nevuchim.
So I was there and I don't remember the answer.
Yeah.
That's even worse.
No, but actually, in the introduction to our Kuzari, you'll find that very quotation. That very quotation is there. What difference does it make to God whether you slaughter the animal from the back of the neck or from the front of the neck? For Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, for the Rambam, by the way, that's the quintessential proof to his position,
right,
which is that the specificity of mitzvot are not for any necessarily inherent reason that you have to do it this way, dafka, and not that way. But rather, God requires uniformity of performance, is that we have some kind of national mode of practice, and therefore there's a desirability in shechita. To eat a dead animal, that's everyone agrees to, right? But does it dafka have to be in that exact location where the Torah prescribes versus another method of shechita, which could be from behind the neck instead of the nape of the neck instead of the throat? So there, the Rambam points to this medrash and says, you see from here that that specific, you know, the specifics of the mitzvah are not the important thing, or don't sort of have sort of an inherent or intrinsic basis. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi would look at that and he would tell you that midrash is not supposed to be taken literally. Every specific of every single mitzvah has purpose, but we have to appreciate that when God gave us that mitzvah, he gave it to us for our benefit, not for Hashem's benefit. That's the way he looks at it. He looks at it as, well, you think God cares how the animal is slaughtered? God cares, is neither pleased more or pleased less how you slaughter the animal, because there's nothing that you can do to affect God. That's the way he looks at that medrash. It's got nothing to do with the benefit of the specifics of the mitzvah, the intrinsic benefits of each specific. It's got to do with, basically, don't ever think that my avoda, my service, changes or in any way enhances Hashem. That's the way he looks at that medrash, okay?
Thank you.
All right, sure. Anything else? Okay.
About the, you said the Ramban about Yaakov when he's with the fight with angel was not actual real, but he got injured. So how would he, you know, say that?
It was all in a dream, because the Torah says that by the morning he was healed.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
I thought it was forever. I thought he said, because he's going to have.
But that was only until the sun showed. If you take a look at Rashi, it says by the time that the sun came up, memory serves me correctly, I have to go back, but to take a look. So by the time the sun came up, he wasn't limping anymore. Okay. Okay. So the rabbi says, we're now in paragraph 10 on the bottom of page 154. The rabbi said, it should not be difficult to understand how one land can be more distinguished from others. You yourself see how one place cultivates a certain type of plant more successfully than other places, or is richer in a certain mineral, or is better for a certain kind of livestock. And you see how the inhabitants of one particular region are distinguished from other people in their appearance and behavior. Additionally, one's physical constitution will determine the completeness or deficiency of one's soul. Therefore, one can also see how one region is more attuned to spirituality than another. So he's really making two points. Point number one is very straightforward. Point number one is that everything that occurs in the physical realm is a metaphor for what is occurring in the spiritual realm. everything. Every scientific phenomenon that we can identify in the physical realm is a metaphor. And I want to, that's really a lot to discuss here. But as it relates to our discussion over here, you know how there are different kinds of soil in different regions, in different geographic regions. And some types of soil are better for one kind of plant, and some kinds of soil are better for another kind of plant. If, you know, I come from Southern California, where there's like an adobe kind of clay soil. It's like, it's got a very rich in iron, but at the same time, there's certain limitations. It doesn't grow. It's a very arid area, so there's certain kinds of plants that need a lot of water that don't grow well there, right? And also the soil is not, it's very unstable, which is not so good because there are earthquakes there, so that's a problem. That's why they have to retrofit everything, not only because of the seismic activity, but because the soil is not conducive to bricks and things like that because of the settling of the soil. But certain soils are rich in certain nutrients and others are not. And you also see how people develop certain physical features and characteristics based upon the geographic regions from which they hail. People that are, you know, live within the Arctic Circle tend to be have fairer skin and lighter hair. People that come from more subtropic regions have darker skin and darker hair. So you say, and we see this even in diaspora Jewry. Ashkenazic Jews have lighter skin and lighter hair. Sephardic Jews have darker skin and darker hair. A lot of it has to do with the unfortunate inbreeding that has taken place over the generations, but a lot of it also has to do with the fact that where you live over the course of one or several generations will eventually affect your appearance. We even can see this, how physical characteristics change even from one generation to the next. You look at immigrants from different countries and you can immediately tell that this person is not Canadian, right? Just by the physical features of their face, because certain cultural mores and attitudes affect the very appearance of your face. And then their children look like Canadians, right? Am I making this up, or does that resonate with me? I think it makes sense. In other words, your cultural attitudes affect your facial appearance. Does it make sense? Right? So all of these things contribute to the physical makeup of a person, and therefore, if that's true on the physical plane, so then it's certainly true on the spiritual plane as well. Wherever you grow up, that's how your neshama grows up as well. And you can pass on some of those spiritual characteristics to your children, and certainly your children will nourish themselves spiritually from whatever spiritual environment you put them in. You either put them in good soil or you put them in bad soil. That's why it's so important for us to make sure our children are raised in the proper environment and not exposed to negative things. Okay. He also points out that, as if you recall going back to the very beginning of the book, he says that one of the reasons why Noach, when he had three sons, he sent Shem, who was the father of all Semites, he sent Shem to the Middle East. And the reason why he did that is because it was the more temperate of the climates. And the temperateness of the climate of Eretz Yisrael has a positive effect on the spiritual makeup of the individual. Now, this is a more controversial position to say that because the climate is more temperate, it affects you in a more positive way. So if you live in a more frigid region, you'll have a more frigid personality. If you live in a hotter region, you'll have a more hot-blooded kind of personality. There is a stereotype that Sephardim are more hot-blooded and Ashkenazim are more cool and stoic. I don't know if that stereotype is true. I don't know. who says it's true?
Yeah. I can tell you right away too.
Sephardi?
I'm Sephardi, my mother's.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a husband.
More emotional.
Yeah.
Very emotional.
Oh,
They're more emotional, no? They're more emotional. Very, like, two sides, you know.
Yeah. So there may be some truth to it, I don't know.
Because it's the weather, Rabbi.
So Canadians are very easygoing because it's much colder.
If you go to Israel, you will see everybody is very warm. They are very, like, because the weather affects your genes, of course.
Yes. Okay.
More colder, more quiet, more
subdued. Even the difference between Latinos and North Americans, right? Yeah. Okay. There you go. I rest my case. Or Rabbi Yehuda rests his case. Okay. So therefore, one can see how one region is more attuned to spirituality than another. So the Kuzari immediately launches into a challenge. I have not heard that the inhabitants of Eretz Yisrael have any advantage over anyone else in the world, because he's looking at 12th century, or perhaps even whenever the book, the narrative is taking place, he's looking at medieval land of Israel, the medieval Middle East, and the medieval Middle East is almost Judenrein, in other words, there's not mostly non-Jews living there, and there's nothing special about the residents of the Middle East than when this book is being written. So this is going to be a big challenge. How is it that we can, on the one hand, claim that the land of Israel has this unique quality, that it breeds the most superlative kind of growths that nourish themselves from the land of Israel, but at the same time, it's only the Jews? And that we're going to leave till next time. So we'll hold it here.